And finally, these bacteria are what they call sulfanogens. They are sulfur-producing bacteria. They produce compounds like sulfuric acid and hydrogen sulfide. These are highly aggressive, poisonous even, substances. And right here, we have one of the reasons why people suffer from colitis and irritable bowel and Crohn's syndrome, and ultimately, cancers of the bowel. So right there is another, that's the fourth item I want to talk about, the importance of the plant food and the right, the volume and the right kind of components of it. There are a number of other issues, but I focused on the main four main ones. We haven't got time to go into them all today. So you might ask yourself, well, when did it all start to go wrong? Well, 60,000 years ago, our ancestors were successful. They were multiplying. Eventually, they expanded out of Africa, and they ended up by filling up the whole world by about 12,000 years ago. By about 12,000 years ago, the whole world was filled up by our peoples migrating all over the place until it was filled up, and they still needed something like 200 square miles, still needed something like 200 square miles per forager band. And they were fighting each other for living space. Still got the archaeological remains of the battlegrounds. Until one day, in what is now Kurdistan, one group discovered how to live on 2 square miles instead of 200 square miles. What was this magic event? Can you give me?
Farming,
exactly. This was the famous farming revolution. The people, instead of wandering around and taking their chances as to what was in their territory, they took control and made sure that what was there was something that they could live on. Now, there were two difficulties with that. First of all, they had to reduce the variety of what they were eating. Instead of eating from something like 100 plants, they reduced it right down to just 3 or 4 plants. And secondly, they didn't actually plant what they would normally have been eating. They planted what it was possible to plant, possible to cultivate, possible to protect from predators, possible to harvest, possible to keep through the winter time, and which kept them alive. And so it was, for the first time in the history of the human race, human beings began to eat birdseed. All right, I'm using a kind of emotive word there. I'm going to put a timeline up, and over on your left, you'll see these first plant foods coming to the diet. So there we have it. Over there, it's wheat and barley. And underneath it, we also have lentils and beans. I don't have time to talk about those. Grains. Wheat and barley are grains, and so is rice, so is oats, so is everything else you know of as being grains. And they're all actually tarred with the same brush. It turns out that grains are not the best things since sliced bread. They actually belong to a major class of plant called monocot, which our bodies were never designed to work with. Human beings are designed to work with dicot plants on the whole. What is the problem with grains? Well, one of the problems is, the major problem with them, is that they are starchy. And starches are nothing other than sugar molecules joined up, and the body unzips that back into sugar in nanoseconds. A slice of toast hits the bloodstream faster than a teaspoonful of sugar. So you're off onto this blood sugar spike, you're into that insulin iceberg, you're depressing the immune system, you're feeding cancers by eating starches. Secondly, grains contain what we call anti-nutrients. These are plant poisons that the plant produces in order to protect itself from insects and whatnot. Now, when it comes to dicot plants, human beings have got defenses, can manage that. But this is a new foodstuff in the human diet. Our bodies never evolved to handle the anti-nutrients. They've got names like lectins, alpha amylase inhibitors, and there is, of course, the big allergen, gluten. Again, I'm just going to give you the bottom line on this, but broadly speaking, they also do two things. They attack the immune system, and they also, in particular the lectins and the gluten, they attack the colon wall, making it leakier. Thirdly, grains are micronutrient poor. They're very poor in micronutrients. So by eating grains, we're starving our bodies of the or our immune systems, or the nourishments it's supposed to be getting. I mean, have you ever wondered why it is on the sides of cornflakes packets they say this product has been enriched with, and then there's a list of vitamins and minerals and so on? Yeah, even governments know that there's something a little bit wrong with grains and they need to be kind of boosted to bring them up to standard. Of course, it's a pathetic attempt because we need tens of thousands of micronutrients, and the few that are put in there are just to make us feel good. They might help a little bit, but they're not by any means all of the picture. And the thing is that with grains, you might think, well, okay, they've been around for 11,000 years and people have been eating a long time, but we've been eating them. We've actually increased our consumption again just in the last 40 years. It's gone up by 50%. Who would have thought it? We're actually more and more substituting the plant food that our grandparents would have eaten, the cabbages and the Brussels sprouts and the green beans and all the rest of it, by grains in its various forms, the pastas. I mean, when I was a kid, we didn't know about pasta. We didn't know about pizza. We had bread, of course. I didn't know what I knew then. Or the other way around. So, grains are for the birds. Next, there's a big tuber that Chaucer had never heard of, Shakespeare had vaguely heard of, and has only really entered the diet in the last couple of hundred years. This tuber is the potato, absolutely. And the potato has very similar characteristics. It's starchy, it's micronutrient poor, it's empty of micronutrients, and it does indeed contain some quite nasty plant poisons called glycoalkaloids. So when you see a potato on your plate, just think of it. I might just as well be eating sugar-coated polystyrene impregnated with pesticide. And finally, there's sugar itself. That San Bushman, people back in prehistoric times, Pleistocene times, they would have been eating a little bit of sugar in the form of honey. And let's not kid ourselves, honey is actually just sugar, the form of sugar. They would be eating of the order of 3 to 4 pounds a year of honey. And in fact, this was much the case for the ordinary person right up until the 1800s. And then by the 1800s, sugarcane plantations were being put in into various parts in the Caribbean in particular, but all various places like Florida and so on, sugarcane production. And the consumption of sugars has risen from £4 per head per year to something like £160 per head per year. So this massive, massive increase in consumption of something which gives you blood sugar spikes is right there, responsible in part, taking share in driving us into cancers. Now, about 6,000 years ago, a group of yak herders in what is now the steppes of the Ukraine conceived a rather bizarre idea of consuming the secretions from the mammary glands of their lactating animals. All right, it's a backhanded way of saying they were drinking yak milk. And indeed, they were drinking the milk of cows and sheep too, because they were herding those. And in due course, these peoples migrated northwest, and they became the Slavs, the Germans, the Anglo-Saxons, the Scandinavians. And these peoples put the idea of consuming milk products onto an industrial scale. It became dairy farming. And in due course, these peoples then migrated too to North America and Australia, New Zealand, carrying this idea with them. And we forget that actually it's a very much a minority occupation. That for most of the peoples of the world, until fairly recently, the idea of consuming dairy products was not only bizarre, it made them sick. How many of you think that this is a normal thing to be doing?
Yeah.
Can you imagine that sand bushman creeping up on an antelope trying to suckle its teeth? Of course, it never happened. And let's not kid ourselves. The milk of the species is for the baby of the species. And I sometimes need to hammer this home. A baby, a mammal baby, whether it be a human baby or a cow baby or whatever, is actually still not a properly formed adult. It is like a chrysalis, ready to turn into a butterfly. Human babies, for example, up until the age of about 4 years old, have a different biochemistry, different digestive system, different requirements, and the only thing that really suits it is to consume human milk. But after that, it changes into the butterfly. It changes into, with a different digestive system, different enzymes, different biochemistry, and from that point on, human milk is no longer good for human beings, let alone cow's milk. I mean, I sometimes say to mothers who are trying to force their kid to have a glass of milk a day, I say, look, why would you do that? Cow's milk, that's designed to build big horns and little brains. Why would you want to have that for your kid? I mean, it's a jokey way of saying, well, look, this isn't actually human food. Now, I wouldn't condemn it outright, because we do eat a lot of things that our bodies have never seen before, but which happen to be fine. But it happens that dairy products are a biochemical disaster. There isn't a human being on this planet who wouldn't be better off never consuming dairy products. Now, when I first started with Nicole, and she's French, and she had a terrible problem getting into some of the stuff I was talking about. She had all the famous recipes and what have you that she was so good at, coming from the south of France. And she had to change a huge amount, but one of the last things she wanted to change was her French cheeses. And I threw her a lifeline. I said, well, actually, of all the dairy products, cheese, for a number of reasons, is probably the least bad. But don't kid yourself, it's not good. It's the least bad. And, you know, and by the time we'd worked on her a bit, because she had started to have a little bit of arthritis, she had digestive problems, she had allergies and various things. By the time we'd sort of worked all these out and she was in good shape again, I said, okay, you can afford to have a little lapse. So from time to time, she has a nice ripe Camembert and a glass of red wine, and that's fine. But it is a lapse. It's a little sinful. Ideally, you wouldn't be doing it. But the bottom line on dairy products in general, people who consume dairy products are more likely to have cancers. In particular, breast cancer, prostate cancer, and so on. So just a little, and one of the ironies, of course, is that consuming dairy products actually is more likely to give you osteoporosis too, and heart disease. So dairy products are one of the big problems too in the Western diet. Okay, we have a question over here. Oh, well, I'll give you all, I'll tell you one thing. I've got my book out there, and I use this when I'm speaking to the doctors, because they ask similar kinds of questions. I have to say, look, there's 32 pages of scientific peer-reviewed references in there, and you know that's the kind of thing, exactly the kind of thing you'll find, because it is. It's in the scientific literature. For example, the Nurses' Health Study was one of those that picked out this in the early days. But then there was the Doctor's Health Study was another one which picked it out for prostate cancer. There's a whole range of studies now which converge on this conclusion. Well, evidence. It's not a conclusion. It's just simply there. You know, you're more likely. It doesn't mean to say you're inevitably going to have cancer. Nothing says you're inevitably going to have cancer. But you're actually undermining your body's ability to deal with cancers by consuming these things. All right, so what does this translate into? I'm just going to give you a quick overview of what this leaves you, because sometimes I get Americans particularly, they say to me, well, you know, what do we have for breakfast? We've taken away our waffles and maple syrup. I say, well, actually, there's a whole range of things you can do, and maybe we can do that in questions and answers later. But this is the kind of thing you're left with. This is the Pleistocene food pyramid, if you like. The British used to have a food pyramid, now the food plate. The Americans still have a kind of food pyramid, but it's quite useful. But broadly speaking, you want to be eating most of low-starch, raw, salad-y type things. Perhaps the next thing is the low starch vegetables, in other words, vegetables which aren't potatoes. And then you would have the low glycemic fruits, and we'll come on to that in a second, and the good proteins. We haven't talked a lot about animal matter, but broadly speaking, almost anything that is animal matter is okay, with the exception of the red meats, and they've got a problem with the fatty acids that's in them. I mean, I talked about the omega-3s, omega-6s, but the saturated fats actually completely scramble everything that's going on in your biochemistry. And until the breeders sort that out, it is possible, because the ancestors of the cow, of the cow, the sheep, and the pig were perfectly good things to be eating. The mouflon, which was the sheep's ancestor, the aurochs, the cow's ancestor, and the wild boar are fine. And if you can get any of those, yeah, that'll be good for you too. But sometimes I give talks, I'm just diverting just a little bit. But I gave a talk in Wyoming. I was the Sheridan Research Institute got me to give a talk to the general public of Sheridan, Wyoming. And as and I was pussyfooting around when I got to this subject, because this is cowboy country. They got cattle herds and everything, and they all walk around with Stetsons on and the high heels and the spurs and the whole thing. I mean, it really is. Somebody asked me the question, well, what about beef? You haven't mentioned it. And I was saying, well, I was trying not to really, because it's not great actually for the human health. And he said, and I said, actually, when I was driving to give this talk here, I was driving through the countryside, I saw there was moose, I saw elk, I saw deer. I said, they'd be all right, but I wouldn't do the beef. And he said, well, that's fine. He said, we ship the beef off to Chicago and New York. We don't care what happens to those people there. Our freezers are full of moose and elk and deer. So yeah, I mean, if you happen to live in a place like that, that's fine.